So welcome to the Reboot Republic podcast, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of hope. We are the podcast of solutions. I'm joined today by my co-host, Martin. Martin, how are you?
Not too bad. And I'd just like to remind everybody, we are the podcast of hope, but a few bob helps keep us going. So please come on, join our Patreon at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Throw a few bob into the kitty there. Thanks very much.
Yes. Indeed, that's it. Keep it going. And we're delighted today to be joined by Shayna Cohn, who is the director of the inequality think tank TASC, and she's also associate of the University of Cambridge. Shayna, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, listen, it's, inequality has been something we've talked a lot about on this podcast. You know, it's one of kind of our core issues that we try and look at and explore. And I suppose, you've written a number of articles recently, and I was quite struck by the one you wrote about the stimulus, the government stimulus package. And while we'll talk broadly about to focus on that first, because there's been a lot of, inequality hasn't really come up as an issue broadly in the kind of whole COVID debate, the COVID discussion. But yet it is clearly at the heart of it, both we're seeing in terms of, who's affected and how people are affected and how governments are responding. What was your kind of sense of kind of that, the government stimulus package, which was about trying to respond to, the economic disaster caused by COVID?
I think it's a logical response, and it does some good things in the sense that it's an emergency measure. You have a situation where a lot of people are going to be laid off, particularly young people, low-paid workers, and among those single parents, migrants, people who don't have maybe the right CV to jump to a better job or to jump to another job quickly. So the emergency measures are needed. What was missing, what is missing, and I hope to see it later in the year with the October budget, is the long-term vision. It's stuck in the pragmatics, but you need a vision. There's some long-term structural problems in Ireland, and the government, for me, should show that it's paying attention to those problems.
What do you see those as?
Well, the fact that there's so many low-paid workers, as my colleague Rob Sweeney has pointed out in our inequality reports, Ireland has a, and it's not just him. You look at SIP2, like Michael Taft at SIP2 or other analysts. Ireland has fairly weak protections for collective bargaining rights. It's not obligatory, and it also has sectors like hospitality that are really dependent on a low-wage workforce. Retail, and it doesn't have to be that way. There are other small open economies in Europe that don't have those kinds of, like, the density of low-paid workers. You have to think, okay, if we have so many low-paid workers and Dublin is the costliest city to live in the EU, there's a problem. So what are we going to do about it? Here's a chance, because it's those sectors that are really having problems, like retail and hospitality, the pubs. So what are we going to do to help in the future? Either those sectors need to be changed dramatically. Some of those businesses are going to go out of business. They're going to go bankrupt. Or we need to make sure that those sectors are properly regulated so they're not so dependent on low-wage workers. Because it's a long-standing problem in Ireland. Unless something's done, then they're going to just be future-related problems like homelessness.
And so what do you see then kind of in terms of that whole area of low pay and precarious work? What you mentioned regulation there. What do you think could have been in the stimulus package around that, or should have been?
I keep citing people who are associated with TASC. We have a board member, Paul Sweeney, and I thought he wrote an editorial in the Irish Times, which I thought was quite appropriate. He said that you need to link, you shouldn't be saving businesses that aren't worth saving, but also we need to link support to better working conditions and worker rights. And I think that's right. There's just too much assumption, or just let's leave it up to the business itself and not regulate for that. But in the long term, I don't think it's good for the business. It's not good for the country.
And in terms of the whole, the area of business, because Ireland, we've got this relationship with multinationals, and, we put ourselves out there as this kind of, we are this low tax, almost zero tax in some cases, light touch regulation, both in terms of the companies and also in terms of workers, a lack of protection for workers. What does that mean in terms of inequality then for Ireland?
Oh, I think eventually reform is going to be imposed on Ireland. I don't think they're going to have much of a choice because besides what's happening now, there's going to be Brexit. And I would think that in exchange for all the support that Ireland's going to need because of Brexit, there's going to be some further discussions about the tax rate. But beyond that, beyond the tax rate, the two-tier economy, again, it's not functional for Ireland. Ireland has a higher percentage than other countries of people who work for small, medium-sized enterprises. So actually, indigenous industry is a really important part of the labor market. And that is, rightly, the government's trying to prop up a lot of those enterprises because they know that that's where the majority of the jobs are. But it's not enough to say we're going to prop you up. What are we going to do about these enterprises? Because despite their relatively large proportion of the labor market, their productivity rates are far below other countries. So they need to be thinking, how can we make those enterprises more productive? We need to address the skill level. We need to address their sustainability in terms of how much money they put away, the kinds of loans they're taking out, what they're selling. But also there needs to be a think about where the economy is going. What are the sectors in Ireland that are going to be productive in the future? Is tourism really going to be the sector that it was before, considering climate change and considering the pandemic? Shouldn't the investment be going into other sectors like, indigenous resources? I keep going back to seaweed, but it has a lot of potential in terms of becoming a resource for different industries, and Ireland has a lot of seaweed. Or, transforming the bogs into something that is carbon sequestration, or reforming the agricultural sector, promoting local businesses, maybe restarting industries like textile that will have to change necessarily in the future because fast fashion is a climate catastrophe. So there may be more sort of local supply chains. There needs to be sort of more vision about what the economy needs to look like 5 to 20 years from now.
There is an opportunity, as they say, never waste a disaster. There is definitely an opportunity here to remake society, to remake the way we move forward. But there doesn't seem to be much impetus to do anything about that. It seems to be try and return to normal, and normal is low pay, normal is high rents. How do we get past that mindset?
I think, again, some of it's going to have to be stick is going to have to be regulation, in the sense of, like, we don't want that economy. The government should say, we're going to seize the opportunity to have a different kind of economy that's going to reduce our market inequality rates, that is going to allow people to live better lives in Ireland. And in order to do that, we're going to make public services, we're going to increase the quality and accessibility of public services, but at the same time, we're going to rethink how our economy is structured, especially like these low paid, low value added industries. We're going to rethink, do they really have a future? Like, is Ireland going to be welcoming thousands and thousands of international tourists? Right now, unless they take my home country, they're accepting Americans, right, to come in. Just to give you an anecdote, I went to try to buy a bottle of wine from a store about a week ago with my husband. He's English and I'm American. And I said, can I see that bottle of wine? And the guy said, when did you land? Like, how long have you been in the country? Because he was about to not sell me a bottle if he thought I had not quarantined. And I say, well, I live here, so don't worry. But he said the other day they had to refuse an American because they hadn't quarantined. So are we really right to be accepting American tourists to come here? Is it that, did that kind of say, okay, we need to keep the economy open for American tourists because they're a big part of that industry, is that really a forward-thinking strategy? And I think it's just symptomatic of not thinking long-term about the implications of what's happening now.
And in terms of that, like, it's really interesting that, we've heard this, experience, Americans living in Ireland, of course, then it's, your whole experience and the impact on that negatively. And, this whole, it's pursuing, you're right to say, it's like it's pursuing the economy in a very short-termist, narrow perspective. It's like the way it's functioning now is how we have to keep it going, because we can't look beyond, where we need to get or where we might actually try to get. And you know, people have talked about this before, this kind of structural problem with kind of part of the civil service in Ireland, the state government, that they don't look beyond this kind of, as we describe it, acute hoor entrepreneurialism. Like, you know, how can we get a quick buck? Not actually how do we, you know, it's our tax, your whole industrial strategy is based on, you know, low and zero tax attraction of these corporates essentially taking taxes away from other countries. But how do you change like the structural way our institutions think? Because it goes beyond just like the politics of each party.
I think both of you gave sort of a great example, or I don't know if it's a great example, but a sort of foray into that. Okay, if all these people are leaving Dublin because it's much cheaper to live there and they can telecommute to work, then what the government should be doing is laying out a plan for regional development and cultivating local businesses. They could say there's a hub, a digital hub in Skibbereen that everybody talks about because it's like the only example. So everybody talks about it. And it's so they could be saying, we're just going to replicate that hub in 40 places in Ireland. You know, we're going to do it in Donegal and places where there are high rates of deprivation. And because we'll have those digital hubs, people will be able to go there to work and be socially distanced. It'll all be very safe. But it also, by having people able to go into a space where they can work, then it means that they can relocate there and there will be the tangential development of other businesses. And it's to say, okay, we're going to start developing local businesses outside of Dublin, local supply chains. Like local food production in Ireland and elsewhere, even in places like the US, is actually done quite well under the pandemic. Like local, I don't know if you've read about this, but local flour mills have done extraordinarily well because people are sitting at home and baking. But it's also because it's short supply chains. And the government, it's just one example. The government could be thinking, what can we do to reduce supply chains to cultivate local businesses in particular industries where we know those global supply chains may not be as easy in the future, but also the inverse of that is if we reduce those supply chains to more local, then we can actually cultivate a number of businesses. Like exponentially, it will be rewarding. And that could be, it could be food production. It could be helping farmers diversify what they grow. And then you have processing, or you have like mills or local abattoirs that are serving a local customer base, but you're also decentralizing the economy and it's building SMEs. But anyway, it's that kind of vision of how to connect it all together that is just not present, but it's a great opportunity to do that.
I see one of the barriers that we face is that we are told that the economy must be saved, or save the economy, as if the economy is something set in stone, instead of being something that's very fluid, very changeable. But the vision we're getting is save the economy exactly as it is now. So I don't see how we get around that, get past that, without talking what type of economy we have.
Oh, you're totally right. And it has to be not just that, but it has to be connected. I think this has been one of the lessons of the pandemic, is it has to be connected to social resilience, to how well the public can respond to an external shock. Because, you know, we could have a climate catastrophe 2 years from now, maybe not a pandemic, but, you know, it could be 2 months straight of rain, right? So some of the, you know, agricultural sector is wiped out, and then there's just... you have flooding and the government has to respond to that. You have people who've lost their homes. This is just sort of one kind of hypothetical example of an external shock. So you have to think it's not just the economy we're trying to rebuild, but how can we make the economy work for society? Because we're going to need a public that is resilient to maybe a very challenging future.
How do you think?
Sorry, Rory, go ahead.
No. Just how do you bring that about?
Again, you don't want low-wage workers, right? Because they're not going to be resilient. They're going to be living in overcrowded conditions if they're not homeless. They are in temporary accommodation and they can't afford health care. So they might be, as we've done research on, they might be right above the qualification for a medical card. So the government should be thinking that the health system does not make the public, does not make the majority of the population resilient because they can't access health services easily without paying for them. So it's not just the economy. The first recognition is not just the economy. Public services have to you have to coordinate the development or the investment in public services and quality of public services with economic development. But also you have to think about the social implications of what you're doing with the economy. Again, it's like, will collective bargaining rights in certain industries help improve working conditions? And by improving work conditions, you give people more security. Because if they have more security, then they're starting to save money. They won't be on the street. They will be able to maybe pay their rent. And they will be able to think about long term, well, with other policies, investing in a house or, you know, helping their children out or helping their parents out. It's not, you can't segregate a temporary measure to keep people in employment from what those jobs are going to do for people and the quality of their lives.
It doesn't bode terribly well that the sectors of society which are most susceptible to change, that they are the ones now also being susceptible to changes in the pandemic payment. They are the ones who are having it caught. They are the struggling people, but they are also the first back to the struggle. Is there a way of squaring that circle? Is there something we should be doing to say these are the people who need the most supports, not the least supports?
Well, the biggest thing, I know, Rory, you agree, besides the health system, the government needs to have a housing strategy. Mm-hmm. So, and that will be for people, directed to people who earn less than a certain amount of money. So whether it's social housing or changing the incentives for in private investment in housing, then if you develop health and you develop housing, you're already creating jobs, and you're creating jobs like long-term employment, because those are going to be areas where there's going to be demand for, you know, health for forever and housing for a long time. So you if you're investing in those sectors, and then you're investing in sectors that will only develop, that are going to be climate friendly, like renewable energy in the future, then you're thinking down the line. But you have to make sure that the conditions are there, that you don't replicate, like you said, the people who are struggling. You don't just have another low wage workforce. You want to invest in sectors that are going to be the future, but also to make sure that the working conditions are present because of regulation. Like it could be that, okay, we're going to invest whatever in renewable energy in Ireland, because like wind farms, because that is the future. And I'm just saying that hypothetically, but we're going to have worker directors, and we're going to have, it's going to have to be a living wage, and they're going to be collective bargaining rights, because economic democracy creates more resilient society, which is what we need.
And it's interesting, you know, that obviously we talk a lot about housing and, you know, and, you know, health as well. And they were both the two issues that were to the forefront of people, of why they voted and the decisions they made when they voted in the last election. And the program for government, you know, what was your sense? Like, was this vision there? Did you think it was in there?
No, it's exactly what you've been saying. It's a kick the can down the road. Let's do the minimum necessary to keep things going. The fact that they're not accelerating universal access to primary care, like really accelerating it within the next couple of years, I think is a big mistake. First of all, if there's the pandemic continues, you want people to have access to health care, because it costs you a lot less money in the long run if people are taking proper care of their health now. If they're obese, they're going to be at higher risk. Or if they have underlying health conditions that aren't going to be treated, then they're going to be at higher risk of suffering from a pandemic, whether it's COVID-19 or something else. Whether there's a nasty strain of flu, you want people to have access to health care or, you know, preventative public health campaigns. I just, I don't understand that. I don't understand why they're not making it a priority, but they're not. They're not making it a priority. That I think is one of the worst mistakes the government's making. And I think they just don't want to take it on. It's like the path of least resistance. If we take that on, then it's too much for us to deal with. We're going to focus on the temporary measures to keep people in work. And that's not right.
It's actually a growing problem. All the waiting lists are growing exponentially at the moment because of the pandemic and because the measures that had to be taken to prepare for the pandemic. But the health system is actually spiraling out of control with waiting lists at the moment. And it's very difficult to see that this government, or indeed any government, could pull it back even to pre-pandemic levels, which is very scary. You have a society then that can't afford to get sick at all. And that's a very precarious precarious situation. And that affects those who are wealthy and those who aren't wealthy. Your system breaks down, it affects everybody equally, unless you have big money to pay privately to go. But at the present moment in time, that private system doesn't really exist. So it's a very, very precarious position for health at the moment for everybody. Is there a way we can quick step into getting this at least manageable again?
Absolutely. I think that the public hospitals, and I know that this is the strategy of the government, the public hospitals have to be for public health care. There shouldn't be any private delivery of health services in public hospitals. But also there needs to be a major recruiting campaign. I mean, Ireland is, you know, it's not an unattractive place to live, but they're suffering from severe shortages in healthcare professionals. So the government should be prioritizing a strategy to say, how can we keep the people who are training from in the medical profession, and how can we attract people here to work in Ireland? And the other side of that is maybe the education itself. We conducted a piece of research, and I remember a senior nurse telling me that a while ago, they got rid of the vocational trajectory to become a nurse, and which meant that particularly women from lower income households couldn't afford the educational process in order to get the degree. So maybe one of the things that they need to be doing, because they are investing in training to get young people into other jobs, is they should be thinking that vocational paths where you can learn on the job is a way to help young people, particularly from lower income households, to get into what would be a fairly stable job. And that should be accelerated in the health profession. So at least you can get rid of the staffing issue. And then you need to make sure that, one investment, that there's a more community-based practices. If you talk to health professionals, and if you look at the countries with scarce resources that have done the best in containing COVID-19, they've had really, really good community-based medicine, like Cuba or Kerala in India. And that's an example for Ireland to adopt, because these places don't have any money. I mean, Kerala and Cuba are not wealthy. They're not wealthy governments. So, but if you have resources in place at a community level and you're training people to take those jobs, then it's a cost-effective way of managing preventative care. But also, if there is a pandemic, then you have people in place at a local level who can monitor the situation. And for me, that, instead of having a children's hospital in Dublin that people can't access if they're living in Donegal, then you need to expand the health service to be countrywide and local and be training people through on-the-job training in order to get into those professions. So you're creating jobs, you're creating a better public health system, and people are healthier. And it's a cost-effective way of doing it. And that's the way the government should be thinking, in my mind.
It is, you know, striking. Like, the inequalities in health are some of the deepest inequalities in Ireland, you know, along with housing and, you know, income and wealth. But health, like, I've been struck over the last while and by these ads you hear for the private medicine and the advertising, you know, the children can get access, you know, they can essentially jump the waiting list and get access to speech and language treatment or even, you know, counseling and things like this. And it shows, because there's a lot of talk of Ireland about, you know, some of the mainstream economists and, you know, media commentators say, oh, inequality isn't so bad in Ireland. You know, we have the most redistributive tax system in the EU. And they, of course, what they don't talk about is all these other inequalities, health and wealth, and health in particular. You see this. And how have you seen, like, that kind of interaction between that private, that we do have a huge inequality in health in Ireland, don't we?
Absolutely. And it's multiple levels. It's not just waiting lists for operations or cancer treatment. The difference for some cancers is remarkable between the private and public health system. I mean, for some, there isn't a difference, but for some other cancers, there are former cancers, there is a big difference. Yeah. And also, if you have a long-term developmental condition, it's very difficult to get into public health services. And if you have comorbidity, if you have multiple issues, then you get tossed between departments, and nobody wants to take responsibility for actually intervening. And I that ends up hurting particularly lower income households where they don't have the resources to advocate for the child. So yeah, I think it's not just the issue of people not accessing the services. It's not healthy for a society to know that some people with resources can live longer because they can access better care and the rest of society can't. It's not good. It's like what Wilkinson and Pickett have said for many years about inequality creating an unhealthier society. And that's what's happening at a pretty glaring level in Ireland. But the government has a chance because we're in the middle of a health crisis to reform the health system, and they're not doing it.
How does TASC overcome, and I'll come back to the voices Rory was talking about, the Economist voices, and in recent weeks we have seen, I think that what can be best summed up as some of you may die, but that's a sacrifice we're willing to take as far as economists are concerned for saving the economy. How does TASC overcome that narrative to become the dominant narrative?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think we have to keep busy and trying to push stuff out on a practical level, but also I think that there's more appetite for an alternative narrative. I think you may not see it. It may not be logical, but votes like Brexit and Trump even, and the fact that progressive candidates are winning in primaries for the Democratic Party in the U.S., I don't know if I would agree with everything everybody says on the left, but the reality is that people want change. I mean, whether it's a vote for a populist leader like Trump or it's just a new kind of, we just are sick of it because we don't want the Band-Aid approach anymore, which is what this government might fall into. Looks like they're doing it for the moment. We want structural change. And I think that since there's an appetite, if we keep pushing it, if TASC keeps pushing it, then hopefully at some point there will be a shift. For the moment, I think people are so panicked that there's so much anxiety, economic anxiety. I think that they want the immediate kind of support. But you even see like small business associations saying the insurance industry here is crazy. Really high rates of insurance. The mortgage and the lending rates are really high compared to other countries. Why isn't the government doing something about that? Because if you don't do something about that, the SMEs still won't survive because you can't borrow money easily. So once your program ends, we're still going to have these long-standing problems. Why aren't you doing anything about that? So what I think might be happening for TASC is that it's not just the kind of progressive academics and Dublin-based middle class that are listening to us, but actually a much broader audience. So that things can't go on like they're going on. We have to have change because the situation is just too dramatic for us, and it'll be a cross-section of the population. I don't think we're there yet, but I think that is the trend.
And do you think that, you know, in terms of TASC and how it sees itself, or even broadly going beyond TASC, like how do we challenge this inequality, and what role do you see like civil society movements, social movements? You know, we've seen it's, you know, from Black Lives Matter, we've seen the Occupy movements, we've seen, you know, even the housing protests, that there's a clear need for civil society to get like active and to put inequality in a way back on the agenda. And how do you think civil society has this role in terms of movements, campaigns, and what do you think are sort of the issues that progressive movements and campaigns could kind of put forward over the coming periods?
I think it's really important for civil society organizations to focus on inequality. It's not that it should overshadow other issues like race, which is another form of inequality, but it's to look at the intersection. And I think that whatever issue you're looking at, whether it's equal rights, regardless of your sexuality or your race or religion, it should be linked to structural economic inequality. And I think that civil society has a really important role because they can keep tying the issues together. Whereas the government has the power to disentangle them, to say, well, this is the issue we're focusing on now, and we can't bother to focus on that issue. Civil society can say, you can't really solve this problem unless you tie it to this other problem. And it's civil society that can, because they... frontline service providers see how complex social problems are on the ground because they're dealing with them on a day-to-day basis. You know, somebody who has mental health issues, maybe homeless, unable to get a job, but can't access income support, or, you know, they can't access to proper treatment so that the cycle is perpetuated. So it's up to that civil society organization to say, unless you, the health service can help this person across multiple issues, then they're going to remain homeless. It's actually going to be more costly for the state to support them in this situation than it would be to provide just better public health services. But the problem with civil society organizations is that they're often trying to survive on a day-to-day basis in terms of their own funding. And they have enough staff turnover because they pay so poorly that you don't have people with the skills or the depth of experience in order to advocate. And I think it would be another cost-effective way, maybe slightly politically risky because you're asking people to criticize you, but for the government to provide stable funding for frontline services, not just in a 3-year period and not through competitive processes, but say, we're going to give this organization 10 years of stable funding and work with them to help understand the kinds of policies that need to be put in place to really address longstanding problems.
I think you're absolutely right around that. That's, you know, and it's a major issue in Ireland, the lack of kind of the, like under the austerity periods, you know, community sector, civil society organizations were disproportionately cut. Their funding was cut. Many of the community development programs were closed. And we know this, Mary Murphy and Pádraig Kirby write about this, that we actually have a deeply insecure state in Ireland that is really worried about criticism and afraid and immature. It can't take or discuss kind of critique. And in that way, it tries to control civil society and civil society organizations. And so in Ireland, then, that makes many civil society organizations afraid of speaking out, afraid of taking critical action. How do you see that kind of, do you experience that or here?
Yeah, definitely. Because we just had a report come out and it, the organization we did it for showed it to somebody in a government department. And they're like, well, we don't necessarily have to listen to what TASC has to say because they just think we're critical, progressive, to lefty people. It does take maturity, and you can see, like, with he's sort of an extreme example, but Trump, who can't take criticism at all, who can't take any kind of criticism, he has to be right regardless. That the worse off you are, the worse the decisions you're making, the more insecure you are about your power. And I think for the Irish government to move on to the next step, and particularly because it's not just a pandemic or the current recession, it's also challenges to the EU and Brexit, climate change that Ireland is facing, that having a robust civil society helps you in a constructive way, because then you can develop better policies. And it also will increase public trust in government decision-making. Because it's that insecurity doesn't generate trust, particularly among younger people. At least it's my impression.
What about transparency in decision making? Are we very lacking in transparency in decision making in Ireland compared to other countries? And does that feed into civil society? Does that make civil society more apprehensive of government?
I don't know if it's that different. Particularly since a lot of countries are going in the wrong direction in terms of transparency. In some of the worst case scenarios, you have in Europe, you have Hungary and Poland, where they're trying to control checks and balances. I think that in Ireland has a robust system. Like, you can see the decision about climate change that Ireland's not. The government needs to do better. That's good. It's reinforced those checks and balances that are important. But civil society here is not as developed as in places like the UK and the US, where there's private funding and there's access to a lot diversified sources of funding. So organizations will have more confidence. They won't be so dependent upon government funding to say, okay, this is what we think needs to be done, and we're not afraid of you cutting our funding. They shouldn't have their funding cut anyway, but that I think is a problem for Ireland, is that there's not enough private philanthropy or there's not enough sort of independent decision-making about funding.
I suppose it is worth pointing out again, and the basis of all, Ireland is a very wealthy country. It's just that the wealth is hoarded in one particular strata, and the wealth isn't used to make a better society. I think it's worth pointing out that we are an extremely wealthy country and that problems are solvable.
Absolutely. No, I think if you tax second homes or you Well, the VAT is actually fairly high, but I think if you do things that and you consider taxing the multinationals more, that there's a way of generating income, but it's also redistributing income within a company. So, I mean, Ireland could be leading in the fact of trying to decrease the hierarchy within companies of pay to say that, okay, we're going to support companies, but you have to have a 50 to 1 ratio between like CEO and the worst paid employee, which like the, you know, somebody who, the cleaning services. We want to go back to that 1950s model or 1960s model of the ratio difference in pay rather than the extraordinary ratio that we have today. Yeah, you could say that it's in order to move forward, we need to have more economic democracy. In order to do that, that the CEOs can't make so much more money than everybody else in the company.
Shana Cohen, thanks so much for joining us today. That was really, really interesting. And it's definitely something we'll come back to in the work of Task. The great work that you're doing, we'll come back to. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.